This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington.
Sergeant at Arms will restore order in the gallery.
It was unusually noisy in the Senate chamber on Saturday as Vice President Mike Pence shared the official confirmation of America's newest Supreme Court justice. It's been a noisy few weeks as senators debated whether Brett Kavanaugh was right for the job. Kavanaugh was confirmed by a vote of 50-48, the closest vote in more than 130 years. He was sworn in hours after the vote, but its ceremonial swearing-in takes place this evening at the White House. The Kavanaugh hearings have energized Americans on all sides, and the midterm terms are less than a month away. What does this confirmation mean to the court and the country? And more importantly for us, where's your head at today, now that this battle is over? Joining us in studio to discuss it is Eliana Johnson, White House reporter for Politico. Eliana, welcome back to 1A.
Great to be here.
Also glad to welcome back Mona Charon, syndicated columnist and senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. Mona, welcome.
Thanks, Josh.
And Inez Stepman, senior contributor at The Federalist. Inez, thanks for making time for us.
Thanks for having me.
We'd also like to make time for your questions and thoughts about what the confirmation of Judge and now Associate Justice Brett Kavanaugh means for this country and what it means to you. We're checking voicemail, so please do give us a call, 855-236-1A1A. Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A@WAMU.org. Today is one of those kind of gut check days where we just want to check in, see where people's heads are at, answer questions, dispel misconceptions. But maybe the first place to start is like, where are we right now? It feels like this has been America's one big story for weeks now. Eliana Johnson, what's your sense of just kind of where we are right now?
Well, I think the Kavanaugh nomination and now confirmation will have some lasting effects. And I think as we get further away from it, it's sort of easier to see it with clarity. The first is that judicial confirmations are getting more polarized. John Roberts was confirmed 78-22, Alito 58-42, Gorsuch 54-45, and now Kavanaugh 50-48. So these votes are becoming narrower and they're occurring more along partisan lines. And I think that will continue, particularly as the prospect of a Republican president potentially replacing a justice who was put on the court by a Democratic president comes up. The next justice to go is likely to be a liberal. They are older. And the second is sort of the opening of places previously considered not open to scrutiny, the high school and college years of not just judicial nominees, but perhaps cabinet secretaries and political candidates to scrutiny. Kavanaugh was one of the first, or maybe the first, to have his high school years open to public scrutiny, and something that almost derailed his confirmation. I think that's a trend likely to continue. Today we saw a CNN reporter under fire for tweets that she sent in college, and she had to apologize for those. So I think those are the two trends that we're likely to see continue, and the Kavanaugh confirmation really set a precedent for them.
Yeah, interesting you bring up the cabinet that kind of gets into that Senate role of advice and consent with federal judges and cabinet positions, and so maybe it kind of opens the door for more politicization in the future. Inez Stepman, where do you see this? Where are we right now?
Well, as opposed to, I think, prior to this confirmation battle, we have a left that's energized and a right that is now energized. I think prior to that, I mean, every poll, every survey of Republican voters showed that they were not as enthusiastic to turn out to the midterms, that the left in this country was energized to oppose Donald Trump in the midterms. And now we have a right that is much more united than it was before this confirmation battle and much more energized. And also, I'd like to note something that Eliana said I think is important. Actually, this bringing in the high school and college years of folks in public life, that'll be really interesting to see how that plays forward for millennials, for my generation, because our college life and part of our high school life is online.
Yeah.
all the silly things that we said and did are findable on the internet, even if we've deleted them. So that'll be an interesting precedent to watch going forward.
Mona Charon, where are we right now?
Well, after the after the fight over Robert Bork, which many on the right considered to be a sort of watershed, because that was the first time that a Supreme Court nomination became an outright gutter political fight. There were, for the first time, ads on television, one famous one by Gregory Peck, the actor, describing Robert Bork as some kind of a right-wing monster. Senator Teddy Kennedy said that a Bork's America would be a place where there would be midnight knocks on the door and minorities and women would live in cower and fear, so forth. And people noted at the time, and Justice Scalia even wrote in one of his dissents, that Supreme Court nominations would continue to play out like political campaigns for as long as the court itself played a political role. And a lot of people on the right have felt over the last several decades that the court has become a super legislature. And it's worse than a legislature because it's not elected and it's not accountable to the people, and yet it makes law. It makes law on incredibly important questions. The conservative critique has long been that, of course, the court does have an important role in deciding what's constitutional and what isn't, and keeping a check on the other branches, but that the court requires modesty, too, and should not be in a position of making the most important decisions about key social issues in our society. And so we are now seeing play out the consequence of what the court has done by intruding itself into areas like abortion, like same-sex marriage, displacing legislatures, and so the fights have become ever more political and vicious.
We are speaking to Mona Charon of the Ethics and Public Policy Center, Eliana Johnson of Politico, and Inez Stepman of The Federalist. We'd love to hear from you as well. We know that you've got opinions about what happened with Brett Kavanaugh. It seemed like the whole nation had opinions, and loud ones at that. And this may be our first chance to kind of take a breath, step back, and think through some of the perspectives that we've had about this. So we'd love to hear from you on this. 1A at WAMU.org. Tweet us at 1A. Comment on our Facebook page, or feel free to give us a call, 855-236-1A1A. Here's a bit of Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell speaking on Saturday about the effects of this whole hearing process. Listen.
We finally discovered the one thing that would fire up the Republican base, and we didn't think of it. The other side did it. The tactics that have been employed both by Judiciary Committee Democratic senators and by the virtual mob that's assaulted all of us in the course of this process has turned our base on fire. I was talking to two of my political advisors yesterday about the advantage that these guys, by their tactics, have given to us going into these red state competitive races. And we're pretty excited. They managed to deliver the only thing we had not been able to figure out how to do, which was to get our folks fired up. The other side is obviously fired up. They have been all year.
That was Senator Mitch McConnell speaking on Saturday. And as that goes to exactly what you're saying, that this has fired up voters on the right for sure. Eliana, I wonder what your sense is of what this has meant for Congress, particularly the Senate, and the kind of maybe scorched earth that has left. One of our listeners commented on that very thing, Laura, who tweeted, "I feel really sad and disappointed. The president and Senator McConnell and Lindsey Graham have been so mean, even in victory, for such a difficult issue. How do we heal the country?" It was interesting, Eliana, to hear the tone of the confirmation from day one, where you had Democrats saying, you know, Senator Grassley, I hold you in very high regard and I respect you, but to day five, when Christine Blasey Ford testified, where it was just, I hope you people never get any power, where Lindsey Graham kind of had that moment. There's got to be a lot of scorched earth in Congress right now.
You know, I don't necessarily think it's the typical job of individual senators and lawmakers to strike a unifying tone, though you did hear that. You heard from several lawmakers that they hope that this is the low point of the Senate. And that the Senate can recover from this. Susan Collins said that. But during the Clarence Thomas confirmation battle over Anita Hill, you had George H.W. Bush come out after Thomas was confirmed and say that he hoped the country could now heal from this vicious battle. And you had Clarence Thomas himself come out at his home and strike the same note. Donald Trump, people may have noticed, is not a unifying president. He's a divider, and he thrives on divisiveness. So this was exactly the sort of battle that, he really thrives on. And he notably did not come out after Kavanaugh was confirmed and say he hopes this can be a time for healing. He was he turned instead to his base. So I don't think that there's going to be a healing from this. I think each side is going to turn to its base and try to get them to turn out for the midterms. And I think that's because we're in a different era, and we're in an era where we have a president who is a base politician, not somebody who turns to the middle.
I know we have to pause in a moment, but worth noting, Inez, that this was one of those where, you know, Republican senators really didn't need to play very nice with the Democrats as long as they didn't lose many votes. They basically had the votes they needed to confirm kind of whoever they wanted.
That's true, but it ignores the block of moderates on the Republican side. And actually, what I think was interesting to note, both in Susan Collins' speech and in the way that Lindsey Graham has been talking for the last few days, I think it's important to note that they've been pointing to the process. Like, the process has enraged them. The way that Democrats on the committee have behaved has enraged them. And I wonder if that is going to damage those relationships between Republican moderates and their friends on the other side of the aisle going forward. Because you don't, I mean, Lindsey Graham is not like a sort of base firing up Republican most of the time. He is a moderate. And to hear the moderates saying, hey, we really didn't like how this went down, and this might damage it going forward.
We'll continue our conversation and get some more of your thoughts in just a moment. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We are discussing Brett Kavanaugh's appointment to the Supreme Court and what it means for the country and for you with Mona Charon, syndicated columnist and senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, Inez Stepman, senior contributor at The Federalist, and Eliana Johnson, White House reporter for Politico. We'd love to hear from you, too. Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, email 1A at WAMU.org, and we are always checking our phone and voicemail at 855-236-1A. This has not been a quiet few weeks, including here in D.C. WAMU's Patrick Madden was there on Saturday as hundreds of people protested on the Capitol steps. About 164 people got arrested. That kind of reflects what we heard from Paula in North Florida, who tweeted, "We better vote like our lives depended on it in November and not let anything go to the Supreme Court if we can possibly help it." Sharon emailed, "I was behind Judge Kavanaugh from the beginning of his confirmation for his stellar record, and I am overjoyed that he's now an associate justice. I am one of the many, many pro-life women that the mainstream media seeks to always minimize, both our numbers and our positions as women." John wrote on our Facebook page, "You can't soft sell this anymore. With unwavering support for Duncan Hunter Jr., Kavanaugh, and Trump, Republicans are okay with philandering and sexual assault. The only reason Ms. Ford was not believed was because she was testifying against a Republican nominee. The right didn't even listen to her, and the FBI, quote-unquote, investigation was a total sham." And John wrote investigation in quotation marks. Mona Charon, I did want to ask you about that in terms of who was believed in this whole process. Set aside for a moment the evidentiary question of whether the Senate should be thinking beyond a reasonable doubt, like in court, or, you know, preponderance. Like, set that aside for just a moment. But just the visceral way in which some people seem to be more believed than others. What did you make of that?
So this episode, like so much in our highly, highly polarized society, is two completely different worldviews. So when Democrats, well, partisan Democrats anyway, look at what happened with Kavanaugh, they see a Republican Party that is misogynist, that doesn't believe women, that diminishes charges of sexual assault, doesn't take them seriously, And they have some things in their quiver. They can point to the Roy Moore episode and to the president himself and so forth. So that's their view. The Republican view is that the allegation of Christine Blasey Ford was, even though it was held until the very last moment, and they're very angry about the process, as Inez was saying, but they also point to the fact that this accusation, the Blasey Ford one, was taken seriously, was listened to, but then it was roped in by many Democrats on the committee with two other allegations that were so absurd that they should not have even passed the laugh test. The one by Julie Swetnick, which she immediately walked back, you know, that there was some sort of rape gang going on in Bethesda, Maryland in the 1980s, and that students, and that she as a college student was attending a lot of high school parties and saw Kavanaugh spiking the drinks of girls with Quaaludes and then attacking them. Well, of course, she walked all of that back. But, and of course, the Ramirez story, too, was quite thin, so thin that the New York Times looked into it and refused to publish it. So so the problem was that when Michael Avenatti sort of collared Swetnick and dragged her forward and included her absurd allegations in with Blasey Ford's more believable accusation, it had the paradoxical effect of making Blasey Ford's case all the weaker, because it was seen to be part of this political hit. And I think Avenatti may have a lot to answer for from his Democratic colleagues.
Well, the president did also make some political hay with Christine Blasey Ford's case, or her story as well. I mean, here's part of what he said at a rally on Wednesday in Mississippi. And an act of what he said was to help defend Brett Kavanaugh and his unfair treatment. Here's a bit of the president kind of characterizing, I think is a generous word, what Professor Ford said to the Senate.
How did you get home? I don't remember. How'd you get there? I don't remember. Where is the place? I don't remember. How many years ago was it? I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. What neighborhood was it in? I don't know. Where's the house? I don't know. Upstairs, downstairs, where was it? I don't know. But I had one beer. That's the only thing I remember. And a man's life is in tatters. A man's life is shattered.
Part of what the president said at his rally last Wednesday in Mississippi. It's worth noting that the president is incorrect in his assertion that all that Professor Ford remembered was having one beer. Indeed, she said that seared into her hippocampus, clearly a psychology professor, was the fact that she was laughed at during the assault.
Yes, she also remembered that it was upstairs. I mean, she remembered many things. The president did not cover himself with glory in that moment where he was mocking her and diminishing her, of course. That was disgusting. On the other hand, there has been a tremendous amount of behavior on the left during this process that was also really lamentable. Stopping people in restaurants and driving people from the public square, accusing someone of absurd charges and not taking into account his whole life. You know, if Judge Kavanaugh were the monster that that some of the Democrats had been portraying, you would think that somebody would have picked up on it at some point in his adult life.
Well, and that's kind of what I'm wondering in a way. I hear you on that, Mona. Eliana, I also kind of noticed that one aspect of the debate around Brett Kavanaugh that seemed to not get a whole lot of mention in the final analysis. It didn't get a lot of mention from Susan Collins in Maine when she gave that like 50-minute explication on the floor of the Senate, which was actually rather fascinating. It's worth hearing if you haven't heard it, is just how Brett Kavanaugh handled the accusation. I mean, if someone accused me of something that awful that I know I did not do, I think I would hope that I'd be able to say, listen, this is an awful thing that happened. It sounds like a tragedy. I wish I could give you the closure you're looking for, but I'm not the person who did it. Like, something about temperament in this whole discussion kind of fell by the wayside.
Yeah, I do think that once the additional allegations came out and Kavanaugh, in his testimony, had to answer not just for Blasey Ford's allegation, but also for the other two allegations. And he was upset angry, in tears, enraged, outraged. Democrats sort of, their argument became one not about necessarily guilt or innocence, but one about temperament. And did he have the appropriate temperament to sit on the bench? And it their argument necessarily, it became one not about do we believe her, but that he doesn't have a judicial temperament. And Republicans answered in turn that Democrats had said he was too blasé in the Fox interview and too detached. And then when he got angry, they thought that wasn't good enough. From a reportorial perspective, the temperament question was an interesting one to me. It sort of seemed to me from afar that looking at the justices on the bench, we know all of their politics based on the presidents who appoint them and based on the way they ruled. So the temperament question was interesting. I'm not sure how relevant it is because we know all the politics of all of the justices. Not really sure how Kavanaugh's temperament plays into it.
With regards to temperament and civility, Sam wrote on our Facebook page, there's a difference between the Thomas and Kavanaugh hearings, referring to Clarence Thomas back in 91. Thomas required 60 votes to confirm. Kavanaugh, only 50. Well, 50 plus one. There's no need for civility for the majority anymore because there's no need to have at least some support from both sides. Inez, what do you make of Sam's comment?
Thomas did not require 60 votes to confirm, but
he did not require 60 votes?
He did not. We've never required 60 votes to confirm. It may have required 60 votes to proceed to the vote, but Clarence Thomas did not get 60 votes.
So you're talking about the vote to kind of suspend debate on the nominee.
Exactly.
The vote for what's called cloture.
Exactly.
And then move on.
Exactly.
Okay. So 60 votes.
And certainly, we saw that question come up here where Lisa Murkowski and others voted for cloture, and there was a question as to whether their vote would stay the same.
Right. Whether it would reflect what their end vote would ultimately
and hers
be.
Did
and
not.
We saw that with McCain also in the health care vote,
right.
Where he voted to proceed but then voted against the package.
Right, right.
But I mean, that the norm now of not requiring the 60 votes for cloture for Supreme Court nominees, I mean, that's one of the things. Actually, Brett Kavanaugh in his testimony said anything in a different context, right? What goes around comes around in politics. That was something that Democrats put in place. And now it's difficult, like, to drop the number of votes for cloture, including for cabinet nominees in particular. That's allowed the Republican Senate to confirm most of Donald Trump's cabinet picks in a way that they would not have with the prior rules. But I do want to kind of circle back just a little bit to this question of leaving aside the standard of evidence or the sort of process element of this. I think that when we talk about believability, there were a lot of Americans who watched those hearings who believed Dr. Ford when she testified and then heard from Brett Kavanaugh and said, no, she's mistaken. And that in itself shows the importance outside of a courtroom setting, in a cultural setting, in the court of public opinion, of at least some kind of fair process where both sides are heard, right? Because I think about all of the Americans who had their minds changed by Brett Kavanaugh's testimony after Dr. Ford's. And I really think this idea about his temperament, that played really, really different. Going back to what Mona said before, we have two completely different worldviews here. On the left, they saw an angry man. I mean, there were some suggestions, I thought, very unfair suggestions, like, oh, we see how he is now. He gets angry. He's probably an angry drunk.
And, of course, there was that SNL cold open with Matt Damon playing Brett Kavanaugh.
And on the right, I think that saved him. I think that after Dr. Ford's testimony, I think there were a lot of Republicans who thought, okay, she seems believable. I don't want to use the word credible because I think that requires evidence, but she seems believable or her story seems plausible. And he came back and they saw the righteous anger of a man who's seen his decades of reputation, come crumbling down over false allegations. And I think that idea that a man should have to sit and listen to allegations that he's a gang rapist without any evidence that Julie Swetnick offered is kind of ludicrous. Like, I think we would all be angry. I don't think it speaks to his judicial temperament. Fortunately, judges don't rule on their own cases. That's why they have recusal.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. Let me get to a few more of your comments now. Dan in Rochester emailed, I am a former anti-abortion male who became a consistently pro-life male many years ago. I would have supported Brett Kavanaugh had it not been for the tenor of his testimony 2 weeks ago, in which he seemed to disqualify himself with his leftist rage against the Dems and Hillary. How can a man with this temperament be impartial at the highest level? Marcy in Cleveland tweeted, "The GOP has proven that they hate women. Rape culture is alive and well in that party. They hijacked the process, changing the rules to suit them. What a joke that they are mad at the Democrats' behavior. Hashtag vote blue. Hashtag vote them all out. Hashtag vote blue 2018. Contrast Marcy's tweet with this voicemail that just landed in our inbox.
My name is Logan from Nashville, Tennessee. I was a two-term Obama voter and slowly woke up to what I saw as a bunch of lies. And I voted for Trump this last time. And I got to say that this whole Kavanaugh debacle, really, this would be a second awakening for me. And a lot of people I've talked to, it really has been. It's been ugly from both sides, but mainly from the left. And I think it's really going to swing badly for liberals in the midterms.
Logan, thanks very much for calling in. And Marcy, also, thanks for sharing your thoughts with us. Mona?
Yeah, so the caller raises an incredibly important point that we haven't gotten to yet, but that's the sort of cultural moment here about the Me Too movement. Because as somebody who I was very well disposed toward the Me Too movement right from the beginning, I think it's a necessary corrective. On the other hand, it seems in this case to have been weaponized for a political outcome. And the standard that the Me Too movement, or at least some advocates of it, and the Democrats seem to want to establish is that an accusation by itself without evidence is enough to sink a man's career and ruin his reputation. And a lot of people are rightly recoiling at that and saying that cannot be the standard. Yes, we have to listen to women respectfully when they come forward and accuse someone, but that doesn't mean that accusation alone is enough.
I wonder, though, if there's any way to even separate those things. I mean, I think about that moment when Jeff Flake was on his way down the elevator. Remember that? When
yeah.
he was in the Senate office building, he's on the fourth floor, he's trying to get to the second floor, and those women held the door open and they were like, look at me when I'm talking to you. What are you doing? I was a survivor. Look what you're doing to me. Finally went down and created that compromise with Senator, with Democratic Senator Chris Coons of Delaware. It feels like this is so personal. It couldn't be anything but political when it hits, like, this is where the rubber meets the road. I mean, even Taylor Swift has come out against Marsha Blackburn for the Democrats as a result of all of this. I mean, here's part of what, and I hate to bring Taylor Swift into this conversation, but here's part of what she posted
on. That's where we are.
That's where we are. Thank you. Exactly. That's the day
well,
that this is.
We haven't heard from Kanye yet. So.
Give it a minute. Give it a minute. Here's part of what Taylor Swift wrote on Instagram. Quote, "So many intelligent, thoughtful, self-possessed people have turned 18 in the past 2 years and now have the right and privilege to make their vote count. But first you need to register, which is quick and easy to do. October 9th is the last day to register to vote in the state of Tennessee," unquote. I mean, this feels like the kind of thing that is so visceral that it's just designed to mobilize people to political action.
But, okay, so here's the thing. Every piece that I've read or testimonial that I've seen in the last few weeks, you know, about I was raped or I was sexually assaulted, therefore I believe that Kavanaugh did this. That's the link that's, in my opinion, really dangerous, right? Because, of course, so many women have been victims. That doesn't mean this man is guilty. I've compared it to any time that you judge people by the group they belong to, right? We're going to judge Kavanaugh because he's a man. I mean, we could say the same thing about, you know, young African-American male is arrested for bank robbery. And, you know, you could say, well, you know, young African-American males are disproportionately caught robbing banks, so therefore this guy must be guilty. That's not the way our justice system works.
Eliana?
I think that the emails and the calls you're reading, that this is something that's absolutely going to mobilize the left. And I do think that because Kavanaugh was confirmed, the right may suffer from this at the ballot box. However, I think that Republicans will happily sacrifice 10, 15, 20, 25 House seats for a seat on the Supreme Court, and that judges are simply a winning issue for conservatives, and they will happily pay a political cost to have a Justice Kavanaugh rather than a defeated Judge Kavanaugh.
Inez, I know you want to jump in on that. I'll give you a chance to do that as soon as we come back. I also want to talk about what this might mean for the court itself. Irwin in Arkansas emailed, "So will Kavanaugh really take the court to the far right? I've been hearing conflicting views from the right where some say he will do so, and others say Kavanaugh will actually be moderate. What will he actually mean for the Supreme Court? Stay close. The Kavanaugh confirmation has been a massive national story, but tomorrow we'd love your help with another big conversation that kind of got eclipsed by all of this, this time about law enforcement. You may have heard that a Chicago police officer is awaiting sentencing on second-degree murder charges in the high-profile shooting of a black teenager. Officer Jason Van Dyke, who is white, was convicted of second-degree murder for killing that teen, Laquan McDonald. It is yet another case that raises questions about police accountability and one of the few that has ended in a murder conviction. Is this a turning point? And what are police relations like where you live? Leave us a voicemail. 855-236-1A1A. We would love to hear from you if you are a law enforcement officer or an activist or just someone trying to stay safe. Tell us your story. 855-236-1A1A. Or you can use our app, 1A Vox Pop, to send us a high-quality audio file and to keep up to date on future topics. We'll share some of your stories tomorrow on 1A. Back now to our conversation with Inez Stepman, Eliana Johnson, and Mona Charon. Inez, let me let you jump in and respond to Eliana's comment before we keep going.
Eliana mentioned that Republicans might suffer in the midterms, and that was a political sacrifice worth making. I actually think that the opposite. I mean, I'm not in the political prognostication business. I think after 2016, that's a dangerous business to
for
be
sure.
in.
For sure, yeah.
But I don't think they'll suffer at all. In fact, especially among Republican women, there's been a big jump in enthusiasm. There's a 12-point upward swing among Republican women, and that's because the left doesn't actually own the voices of women. For a lot of women out there, this hearing is about fairness. It was about fairness for their husbands, their fathers, their sons. Got a lot of boy moms who are really scared about the standard that Mona mentioned, right? The idea that a single accusation without any kind of corroborating evidence is enough to destroy a man's life. I think there are a lot of women who see a problem with that standard as well, and they are also energized to come out to vote.
This is no doubt very, very visceral for quite a lot of you, including Jean. Jean contacted us and wrote, "We are more concerned with the men who are falsely accused 2-5% of the time than the women who are raped 95-98% of the time. When 1 in 4 women in America deal with rape and tens of thousands of rape kits remain untested, there are bigger issues than your panel is talking about. Our justice system is broken. The women on your panel are making my blood boil." Hmm. Are we losing sight of something larger here?
The problem of rape has always been with us as long as there's been human civilization.
And I'm sorry, Mona, I hate to interrupt you, but I just want to clarify something from the comment. The commenter wrote that 1 in 4 women in America deal with rape. Senator Dianne Feinstein in the hearing said that according to federal statistics, it's 1 in 3. That 1 in 3 women will deal with sexual violence of some kind.
Not rape. That's way overstated.
Well, sexual violence of
sexual,
some kind.
So, and that's a very, very broad description that includes even just being fondled over your clothes against your will. So,
right.
So
we should just be careful with the number.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Okay. So, yeah, the number is not right. But look, the problem of male sexual aggression has been a problem throughout human civilization. All civilized societies seek to cope with it. And it's also one of the most difficult crimes to prosecute because in most cases, there are only 2 people. It happens in privacy. There are no witnesses. It's very hard to show proof if there was no actual, if there were no wounds on the woman's body, et cetera, et cetera. So it is, you know, when people say, well, we're not being believed, it's because it's very hard to prove. And also you have to recognize that the consequences of finding someone guilty of rape mean years and years and years in prison. And so, of course, we do need to be careful about how we evaluate rape accusations. It's an awful thing. But I don't see any way around, you know, keeping in mind our standards of justice and fair play, I don't see any way around the difficulties inherent in these kinds of accusations.
I feel like this is one of those moments, Eliana, though, where a lot of women, including several who've commented on this program, not that I think that this show is a perfectly representative sample of the country, but a preponderance of the women who've commented on this program have essentially said, I don't want to hear it. We've been waiting for all of human history for our society to deal with the fact that men can treat women like pieces of meat and get away with it with impunity. That day is over yesterday. So fix this or we will shut you down until you do. I hear you, Mona, but it's that emotional, visceral part of politics, Eliana. I don't think that the political will is there, especially among women who have been assaulted, to say, okay, I'll take a breath and wait another term for this to get better.
Well, I think there are two challenges. The first is that we have a justice system based on a presumption of innocence, and the Kavanaugh confirmation presented another challenge, which is that he was not being tried in a court of law. And the question raised in it was, should he benefit from the presumption of innocence? And we had a lot of senators saying, no, he should have the presumption of guilt and he should have to clear his name. And that seemed not to go over well. There was a political backlash on the right to that. And so I think that there certainly is energy on the left, but it is met with equal force from energy on the right, with people who feel that that's greatly unfair. But the Kavanaugh confirmation in saying that men should face a presumption of guilt when an accusation is leveled was sort of met with an equal and opposite energy from the right. And emailers and callers can say that that makes their blood boil. But covering this as a reporter, that is simply sort of what we saw.
I do want to move on and talk about the impact on the Supreme Court, but I should note that this has left some of you, just regardless of your politics, feeling very cynical about the process overall. I mean, this was very high political theater in some ways when you get down to it, and that was kind of the reflection of one listener who just left a note in our inbox.
My name is Florence. I'm calling from Cleveland, Ohio. I'm very disappointed in our congressman, and I'm very disappointed with the United States at this time, being an African American woman. I really do feel that it was all a big joke, that they went behind doors and said, okay, let's give the country a good show. They already knew what they were going to do. It's not a government by the people. Only a particular group of people.
Florence, I appreciate you calling in and sharing your thoughts with us. Let me get to a few more comments as we continue. Tina in Grand Rapids, Michigan, emailed, I'm so sick and tired of people talking about Kavanaugh's reputation and life being ruined. That is absolutely ridiculous. He is a wealthy, privileged white man whose life is nowhere near ruined. Obviously, now he's been confirmed and will be on the Supreme Court. Her life is the one that has been ruined, if anyone's life has been ruined. The Me Too movement has not been weaponized for a political gain, and I'm upset that your guest just said that on the air. So angry right now. This is real for women. Irwin in Arkansas emailed, so will Kavanaugh really take the court to the far right? I've been hearing conflicting views from the right, where some say he will do so, and others say Kavanaugh will actually be moderate. Inez Stepman, this gets to something that Senator Collins of Maine, Susan Collins of Maine, talked about in her long explication explaining why she was going to vote for Brett Kavanaugh and some of his background, particularly as it relates to dealing with precedents on the Supreme Court. She mentioned Roe versus Wade very specifically. What's your read on whether or not Brett Kavanaugh will drag the court kind of as Irwin suggested to the far right?
Look, because he's replacing Anthony Kennedy, I think there will be a shift to the right on the court. I think it will be much more measured than some are claiming. I think it's really unlikely that you see Roe versus Wade, something like precedent overturned. I think it's much more likely that we see some narrowing of the precedent on abortion, allowing states a little bit more leeway to regulate abortion in the second and third trimesters. I think that's more a likely outcome on those issues. I do think that Susan Collins overstated Kavanaugh's moderate credentials a little bit in her speech. Because he was, as a judge on the appellate court, he was following Supreme Court precedent. His job as a judge was try to guess how the Supreme Court would rule on a particular issue given the precedent. Now that he is setting that precedent, he's free to rule on what he thinks that precedent should be. I do think something that's undercovered, we may now have, I don't think that we have the votes on the Supreme Court to overturn Roe versus Wade. I do think that we have the votes on the court potentially to narrow something called the Chevron precedent that grants federal agencies incredible latitude, that grants them a lot of latitude from the courts to interpret the statutes that they are then regulating on. So I think in terms of agency power, regulatory power, the administrative state, not as sexy a topic, I know, but I think
we've actually talked about
important.
It on the show.
It is to
yeah,
me.
Yeah. I think it's an incredibly important issue. So I was excited as a conservative to hear that Brett Kavanaugh is quite strong on this issue, and he has a very strong record on the D.C. Court of Appeals on this issue.
Love to hear a clip from one of our listeners who is concerned about the future of the Supreme Court as a result of this process. Here's what she left in our inbox.
This is Jane Elkin Thomas from Louisville, Kentucky, and I feel this is a sad day for America. The Republicans and Mitch McConnell has made our Supreme Court into a political institution and not the fair, just judicial court that it is designed to be.
Jane, I appreciate you calling in. Thanks for talking to us. I wonder, Eliana, what you make of Jane's comment. I heard what you said earlier in terms of these votes, these confirmation votes getting narrower and narrower. But, you know, the Supreme Court has always been something of a political football to varying degrees, basically throughout American history.
You know, Mona made a comment at the beginning of the show that I think was spot on, that I think as Congress has sort of abnegated its role as the legislative body, the Supreme Court has kind of stepped in to play that role, ruling on sort of the hot button political issues of the day, and as a result has become a real political football with every nomination being hotly contested. And I think it is likely to stay that way because people have a sense, and I think a correct sense, that the Supreme Court plays an enormous role over the shape of the country and the political shape of the country. And that's really the role Congress should play in, but Congress is not playing that role. Congress and the state legislators are not playing that role to the extent that they should be. And as a result, people perceive the court correctly as a increasingly a political body.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. Inez?
I absolutely agree with Eliana. It hasn't been made political by this nomination. And in fact, we saw Senator Ben Sasse, make this exact point prior to all of these allegations in the normal hearing portion of this confirmation battle, saying, hey, these protesters shouldn't be in front of the Supreme Court. They should be in front of Congress. Congress has totally abandoned its role as the legislature and has increasingly shifted off that role either to the Supreme Court or to the executive agency. Agencies. And that's just a very, I think, a long-term problematic development for
it is.
The United States.
And if I can just jump in, let's bear in mind why they're doing this. Congress is doing this out of cowardice, right? Because they they're protecting
fortunes.
Their own interests. They don't want to have to take tough votes and alienate some of their constituents. And so they want to push off the power to other people. This is to other branches of government.
Let me get to one more voicemail that we asked regarding your thoughts about this process and what impact it has on you. Here's one more listener who left a note in our inbox.
Hi, my name is Liz, and I'm calling from Cleveland. I am a conservative, registered Republican, and I support Dr. Ford 100%. I think this should not be an issue which divides Republicans and Democrats. Assault is never okay. It's never okay to cross someone's boundaries without their permission. And that is what I'm teaching my two elementary school children. I'm using this as a learning tool. And I also would like to add, at the age of 42, I remember being in college, and date rape was something that did happen. And women often felt shamed because they felt as though they were in the wrong place at the wrong time, and the man had gotten carried away. That is why, knowing history and where we've been, I support Dr. Ford.
Liz, thanks very much for calling in. I wonder if Liz's comment kind of gives us a way to wrap up this conversation in terms of the conversation that happens now. We've heard from a number of listeners in terms of the discussion that they're having with their kids, particularly boys, who, you know, moms of boys who are talking about this. Here's a bit of what David Marcus, who's a New York correspondent for The Federalist, wrote in today's New York Times. David writes, quote, "The task for conservatives in the wake of these ugly 2 weeks is not to point and laugh, but to show care and compassion that may build trust in Mr. Kavanaugh and the court among those who so bitterly and sincerely opposed him. There is plenty of blame for the tribalism in our country to go around. Ending it, however, is a task best undertaken by the side that is winning." Unquote. That's part of what David Marcus, who is a New York-based correspondent for The Federalist, wrote in today's New York Times. I wonder where we see that conversation happening, if we see that conversation happening, and what that might look like. Mona?
Yeah, I just wrote a book about some of these matters. It's called Sex Matters, and it's a plea, really, for us to grapple better with what's gone wrong between men and women, what's gone wrong with the sexual ecosystem that we've created in the wake of the sexual revolution, where the rules are not clear at all about how to behave, and where, honestly, I think we could find some common ground between Me Too and feminism and social conservatism, because we all agree that bad male behavior is a scourge and that it has become all too common. The question is whether we can see that as the unifying issue, and that women and men of goodwill from both sides can look for reforms of how we're socializing children.
Inez, briefly before we go, where do you see that conversation going?
Well, I think that's an interesting point that Mona made. I think there might be some common ground there. Full disclosure, Dave is a friend of mine and a colleague at The Federalist. I think it's going to be difficult, though. I think Republicans look at the way that this hearing was handled, not necessarily at Dr. Ford herself. And in fact, I would point out that the Republicans on the committee were quite respectful, that the hearing was quite respectful. They gave her a full opportunity to speak. They did not, you know, harshly question her. They had a prosecutor and a sexual assault
expert.
Question her quite gently, and actually I think that is to the that is perhaps, and on a positive note, that is something we I think have moved forward on in the culture, that, you know, sexual assault victims should be heard. That doesn't necessarily mean we take their word as the final say on what happens over to a man's life.
Inez Stepman, senior contributor at The Federalist, Eliana Johnson, White House reporter for Politico, and Mona Charon of the Ethics and Public Policy Center, thank you all for being with us. This show was produced by Bianca Martin. To learn more about her and the rest of the team, visit the1a.org/staff. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. This is 1A.